Welcome to Securing America with me, Frank Gaffney, the program that's a kind of owner's manual for protecting the country we love against all enemies, foreign and domestic, to God's glory and that of his kingdom. We have witnessed an extraordinary spectacle, I think it's fair to call it, over the past week now, election week, some are calling it. No longer election day, possibly looming is election month, when the returns of all of these ballots, many of them mailed in, are processed painfully slowly, despite an array of exotic machines whose principal purpose, as best I can tell, is to try to make sure that we get very rapid calculations as to who won on any given day in any given race. A man who has lived and breathed politics at the highest levels for a long time, I'm very pleased to say, is here to make sense of all of this for us, if it's possible. And not only what has happened so far, what we know of what has happened so far, but also perhaps to give us some insights as to what might be in the offing, not least with respect to the leadership decisions that are now pending in the United States House and Senate as we speak. His name is Ed Corrigan. I've been privileged to know him for a long time and consider him one of the best in the business. He has been at the forefront of efforts in the senior ranks of our Congress for quite some time to assure conservative values, and those who protect them are as formidable a force as they can be, notably in his role as the staff director for the Republican Steering Committee in the United States Senate. These days, he is the president of an important organization founded by former Senator Jim DeMint, titled the Conservative Partnership Institute here in Washington, D.C. And he's always a welcome guest here. Hasn't been for a long time, but we're delighted to have him back. Ed Corrigan, thank you so much for joining us. Welcome.
Well, thanks so much for having me, Frank, and thank you for what you do.
Well, let's talk about what you have done and the insights that it's given you into what on earth is going on at the moment. Give us a readout, Ed, from your vantage point now with an organization that was very much involved in election integrity efforts. Did we have election integrity in this 2022 midterms?
Well, thanks, Frank. It's a great question. It doesn't appear so. I think in some ways we did and have improvements, but in some ways we may still have a ways to go. And I don't know that we really know exactly. I think a lot of the ballots are still being counted in certain areas. In any election that's this close, you're going to have people who are going to want to inspect the process and so forth. So that a lot of that's taking place. We did have, as you know, we've been doing a lot of training and trying to help people navigate how they can participate in the process, whether it be as poll workers, observers, things like that. I think the more people you can have participating in the democratic process, the better product you're going to get at the end of the day. And so that's something that all Americans and certainly all conservatives need to be more actively engaged with.
That effort was really commendable, and it was a very concerted one, training up thousands and thousands and thousands of poll watchers and election officials and others to try to make sure that what were counted were legal ballots and that they were made, obviously, by people who are entitled to cast their ballots. There seems to have been, at the same time that Republicans were focused on getting the largest turnout possible, a corresponding effort, maybe even more powerful effort by the Democrats to affect the turn-in, as one of our friends has put it. The ballots, in other words, whether they were legal or not, whether they were cast by people who were entitled to cast them or not, nonetheless were being fed into the machine and processed and may indeed have affected the outcome, despite the best efforts of all of those you know, precinct captains and poll watchers and so on to have eyes on it and keep that from happening. Is that a concern of yours?
Yeah, I mean, I think anytime you have these elections, you're going to want to find out what happened. And there are certain process that have come about over the last decade or so. Certainly, the proliferation of mail-in ballots and you know even in some places ballot harvesting is definitely a troublesome. And it makes it difficult to really to make sure the process is has integrity and is fulfilling, you know, not disenfranchising voters. You know, obviously the political political process is you know, it's combative. You want to have people you know, engaging in forceful debate. And you want to have people, you know,
forceful but not violent.
Not violent,
to say.
Of course. You want to have basically just a robust conversation, mm-hmm. and that's what we want in the electoral process. But then once it comes to counting the votes, you want it to be something that people can be confident in and be and can trust that the result was fair and free election.
Yeah, you know, you made such an interesting and really important point in that comment about disenfranchisement. Because it's not just that people who aren't actually entitled to vote or vote more than once, at least, are sometimes having a disproportionate impact. But it's actually that at least some of those votes negate the votes of people who are casting legal ballots. So you're absolutely right. This is obviously fundamental to how those of us who are entitled, indeed have a duty to cast ballots in these elections, have a special stake in making sure that the process is truly free and fair. And again, just kind of a top line assessment based on what we know now, the very fact that this race, well, and there were myriad races, of course, it was a midterm election, but there were hundreds and hundreds of races across the country. But that they were in so many cases so close was rather stunning, given that, you know, the polling suggested it would be otherwise. The rallies seemed to demonstrate that the Republicans had a vastly higher level of participation and engagement and passion than their Democratic counterparts. And yet, in some cases, not only were they close, but the Democrats actually prevailed where they were not expected to do so. Would you characterize, based on what you know now, to be sure, what has happened as free and fair elections as a general rule?
Well, you know, it's one of those things that I think you need to do after every election. You need to do an assessment. And I think that's what's happening right now. Of course, right now, you're still there's still counting going on, and there's still the process of observing and making sure that counting process is done properly. But then you not only need an assessment on the electoral process itself, but also as a political party. You know, each party is going to want to do an assessment of their strategy, and what was, how did you approach the election? What was the strategy? Did it work? What needs to be adjusted for the future? And so those are the kinds of things that I think you're going to have to see the leadership of the party to do that.
Well, that's what I want to turn to next. We have to take a short break. Ed Corrigan is with us, formerly with the Republican Steering Committee in the United States Senate, a longtime real leader in that committee and the role that it played in the Senate, now with the Conservative Partnership Institute. We'll talk about all of this and more right after this message. This is Frank Affney with the Secure Freedom Minute. Tens of millions of Americans are bitterly disappointed by the outcomes of the midterms, too many of which remain unresolved. Numerous factors contributed to victories by candidates clearly less enthusiastically supported, and in at least one case, palpably unfit to serve. Those include the fact that Republicans focused on turnout, while Democrats focused on turn-in, namely generating and counting ballots whether they were legally cast or not. Another determinant was the failure of the McLeadership, the GOP Senate leader Mitch McConnell, Kevin McCarthy in the House, and Republican National Committee Chairwoman Rona McDaniels to support and fund the party's nominees in key races around the country. Specifically, they sabotaged candidates deemed insufficiently loyal to them and their reduction of the party basically to a controlled opposition in Congress. Will these so-called leaders be rewarded by being re-upped? The answer must be no. This is Frank Gaffney. We're back. We are talking about the midterm elections, what we know happened in their course, what we don't know quite yet happened, and most especially the need for a serious retrospective look at, how, among others, the leadership of the Republican Party performed in the course of the election, which may have had real impacts and particularly in some contested races where funding seemed to be denied to Republican nominees for congressional seats or for Senate seats, with, it seems, devastating effects. Sometimes the elections were quite close, and it almost certainly would have made a difference. So, Ed, as you talked about the leadership taking stock of their strategy, what worked, what didn't work. How would you characterize the sort of role that was played by a man you worked with for many years, Senator Mitch McConnell, the minority leader at the moment in the United States Senate, and his counterpart in the House, Kevin McCarthy, the man who hopes to become the speaker if the Republicans do, in fact, prevail there?
Well, thanks. Yeah, I think the there's a couple of elements to that. The first is what was the message and that was being communicated to the voters? What was the reason being given to elect Republicans? The second is, of course, money and campaigns and how is it spent and was it spent wisely and was it spent in the right places? On the first question, I think one of the things that a lot of folks are frustrated with is that it didn't seem nationally that the Republican voters had been given a clear message of what it is that we're trying to accomplish, what it is that we would do if we were entrusted by the voters with leadership in the House and Senate. And in fact, it almost seemed that there was a concerted effort not to do that. Senator Rick Scott of Florida, who's also the chairman of the Republican Senatorial Committee, he put out what he felt was a good policy agenda. A lot of folks read his agenda and really liked a lot of the ideas in there. And he was attacked by the Republican leader for putting out an agenda. Their view was that we should not have an agenda. We should just say the Democrats are no good, and therefore the voters will vote for us. I think that obviously that strategy failed. And so as part of this assessment, I think we need to, because when you see times like the famously the Contract with America in 1994, Republicans offered up a robust agenda and took the Congress for the first time in many, many years. That's an example. If you give the voters something to be excited about, they're going to respond favorably.
Yeah. You know, I feel that very strongly, having been imprinted back in the 1980 campaign with Ronald Reagan very explicitly laying out an agenda and committing, notably, among other things, to defeating the Soviet Union and getting a right. mandate to do it. You know, as you say, it was something that people could embrace and endorse and expect to get done. And that's what's so, I think, troubling in both the House and the Senate. It seemed as though, as you say, they were running on the platform that we're not as bad as those guys. And that's not necessarily the sort of thing that excites people or let alone gets them out to the polls. So we have leadership races, I guess you might call them that, underway as we speak, the outcome of which is a little unclear, though the odds are that the two people who hold the jobs today or have in the past session will again prevail. Do you think that's right, Ed Corrigan? And do you think that's what should happen in this setting?
So it's interesting. I'll take each house separately because you got a lot of action and interesting things going on in each house. And there's different procedures that are specific to each house. I'll start with the Senate, where I spent most of my career. The Senate process is supposed to have an election in January after the new members are sworn in. And as you
that's
know,
actually in the rules.
The rules, it says it's supposed to be happening after the new Congress is sworn in, and the vote would be within the Republican conference. And basically, right now there's still a Senate seat that hasn't been decided. There's going to be a runoff in Georgia between Warnock and Walker. That's going to be on December 6th. So a lot of the senators, conservative senators, and even Senator Lindsey Graham. Have called for the election to be delayed. The election is currently scheduled for tomorrow, and that's way ahead of what would normally be the time for the election. And so there's a lot of push to sort of push it off, and let's see what happens. If Herschel Walker were to become a senator, he'd want to be a part of this conversation. And so there's some thought of potentially delaying that. On the House side, the interesting thing that's going on in the House, the majority is looking like it looks like the Republicans will win the majority, although there's still a lot of counting happening.
Mostly blue states, I think it's fair to say, too, which is a little concerning.
If there is a Republican majority, it's most certainly going to be very narrow. Could be one of the most narrow majorities in history. In which case, you really are dealing with every faction in the party is going to have a say in what's happening. And in particular, the faction that's been the most active and had taken a serious interest in the process is the House Freedom Caucus. And they have been meeting all last week, and they're meeting again this week and trying to come up with what their strategy is and engaging with the folks who are running for leader. Kevin McCarthy, obviously, is the one who's the current leader. And so you would expect him to run again. And they're going to try and have an election there. But the elections in the House, even though they'll have a conference election, the real vote for the Speaker will happen on January 3rd. And so and on the January 3rd vote, they need 218 rather than just half of a conference. So he's going to need to deal with a lot of these members. In particular, he's going to need to deal with the Freedom Caucus, or whoever is going to be the next Speaker is going to have the support of the Freedom Caucus in order to do that. And so they're asking for some very reasonable things on how they want the House to operate, empowering members, being a more participative process and a conservative agenda, things that you would think any Republican leader would want to deliver on.
And the regular order, among other things.
That's right. Yeah.
Return to it. You know, I personally am very heartened by the prospect that conservative members of the House, notably organized now under Scott Perry, the chairman of the House Freedom Caucus, would have that kind of, perhaps kingmaking role. Yeah. And if the question is, if the vote in the House is forced, and as we're speaking, it's tomorrow, Tuesday, I think, there as well, would that be binding on what would come when those new members are sworn in and they get a chance to vote?
No, it is who would be offered up by the Republican conference. But remember, since he would need only, you know, maybe 110, 112, whatever the majority of the conference is to win on tomorrow, he would need 218 to win on the floor. And so I think whoever wins the vote for Speaker tomorrow, if that vote is not delayed, is going to still have to deal with the various members of the conference, because in order to be speaker, you have to have 218 votes. And so that is going to be a big question going into January. And it's going to be something that that there's going to be a lot of conversations happening over the next few weeks.
For sure. Can I put you on the spot,
yes, sir,
my friend Ed Corrigan, and just ask you, should, in your estimation, there be new leadership in both the Senate and the House?
Well, I think there needs to certainly be a new style of leadership. And I think basically the current leadership in both houses has been way too confined, and all decision making is being made by shadowy staff and some leadership office. I think we need to have something where it's more opened up. Conservatives are able to be a participant in the process. Who that leader should be, I think, is something that I'd like to leave up to the members. But the House Freedom Caucus I think they're likely to put a name forward. If that happens, I think that I'd like to see a strong showing there.
Amen. Thank you, Ed, for your postmortem, as they say, on what has happened so far, as well as your crystal ball gazing. We appreciate it so much. We value your leadership. Come back to us with updates if you would. We're going to talk about energy security next, or the lack thereof, with the great Dave Walsh right after this.
And throw Molotov cocktails in an effort to destroy police stations, federal courthouses, and local businesses, all in the name of anti-fascism. Most Americans are now, sadly, all too aware of the movement known as Antifa. But where did they come from? What do they want? And how do we stop their campaign of violent mayhem? The Center for Security Policy Press is proud to present Unmasking Antifa, Five Perspectives on a Growing Threat. This new book looks at the history, ideology, organization, finances, and strategy of Antifa, provides an in-depth analysis for law enforcement officers, policymakers, and the general public. From street fighting tactics of the Black Bloc to fundraising by prominent left-wing foundations, Unmasking Antifa is the go-to guide to understand this elusive and dangerous threat. Get your copy of Unmasking Antifa, Five Perspectives on a Growing Threat at Amazon.com.
Welcome back. When we want insights into a world that most of us are profoundly impacted by, but don't frankly understand very well, namely energy, the implications of not having energy security specifically, and why it is that a government like ours would deliberately deprive us of energy security. The man we turn to, as do others, is, of course, Dave Walsh. He is a longtime senior executive in the energy sector, worked for Mitsubishi Power for a time, is these days a principal in the Toshiba Group, an important consulting firm in the energy space. And you see him on War Room and this program and elsewhere. Thanks be to God with frequency, because we profoundly need his counsel, insights, and guidance. Dave Walsh, once again, welcome back to Securing America. It's great to have you with us.
Thank you, Frank. Good to be here.
I wanted to talk to you about something that we spoke of a couple of weeks ago, at a time we were told that a potential catastrophe was a month away. I'm hoping that something's been done to keep the wolf at bay, but if not, we've lost 2 weeks, so are we now 2 weeks closer, maybe 2 weeks away, from having a profound economic shock, perhaps even a safe public safety and health shock, and even a national security shock, namely that we will lack diesel fuel to operate, especially our transportation sector and everything that depends upon it.
Well, Frank, we had a, you know, we had a hiatus on the topic in the media prior to the vote counting event beginning last Tuesday. So, of course, in PR space, no reason to talk about negativity, which is very substantial in the case of diesel. Shortly after the vote counting event on Tuesday began, we had Newsweek, we've had the Washington Post in the last 2 to 3 days begin to sound the bells again, appropriately, after the event, and the PR now doesn't matter, that, hey, there is an issue here, even in the main media. And then the issue is this. We had, you know, mid-October, we were down a 26-day supply. We 24.5. We blipped up to 26 days in the last couple weeks. Still the lowest level in 70 years of diesel oil heading into the winter. Pricing at all-time high this year, $5.40 a gallon, up from the October average by 20 cents already. President Biden has invoked in his rhetoric to oil majors to refine more that we are in a war emergency powers period, and war powers may be invoked to get them to act out on refining more. So here again, we've used the war powers, we've used the rhetoric about being at war while the southern border is open to all those from China, Russia, and others who we can't discriminate against, no matter what warring nation they're a part of, to walk in. And of course, while we're doing little about this, he missed.
So just so I'm clear, you're saying that despite the fact that 2 weeks have passed, we're not left with 2 weeks. We're still left with about a month's worth of diesel supply.
Yeah, okay. The present supply is 26 days, lowest inventory in 70 years.
Okay. So, but you're also saying, Dave, if I understood you correctly, you were a little euphemistic about this, but the press did not want to talk about this before the election because it might have had some bearing on the public's decision as to keep re-upping the people who brought us to this pass.
Of course not. I mean, if you're embrace the fact that the mainstream is the propaganda arm of this government, of course they wouldn't want to discuss a significant supply chain perturbation in the 2 weeks prior to the election. Now,
I'd like to say I'm shocked. I'm not shocked, but I am horrified just the same.
Now that it's over, or the PR part of it's over, we're still on the course to counting month.
Yeah.
They've begun to ring the chimes about this. Yeah, it is a serious issue.
Right. And have we gotten any relief in terms of structural reform? And would the invocation of the War Powers Act materially change that?
Now, there's a couple things could be done. I mean, one opportunity was punted royally by the administration 2 weeks ago, announced another a final 15 million barrel tranche of SPR release by global auction again. Presented the opportunity to arbitrage that with the majors in exchange for diesel. Here, I'll price this to you at X. You come back to me with a price, whatever the clearing price is. You bring me back an equivalency of diesel and conduct that kind of auction. Could have been helpful. Opportunity completely missed. The SPR release was issued into the global supply chain at auction as per normal without the creativity of how to address this issue. You know, that could have been done. President Trump easily would have done something like that because he thinks like a business person. How do you arbitrage what you have and what you're auctioning off to get perhaps what is desperately needed? So there's not much being done. Another, there's an act that prohibits the transit of goods from port to port by international shipping vessels. It would easily be lifted, the Jones Act. It's been in place for decades. The unions love it. The stevedores love it because you only have a U.S. vessel able to transport from Boston to Savannah, from Savannah to Charleston, Charleston to L.A. Only U.S. vessels can do that. Same, you know, with airlines. If that were relieved, the supply chain would free up because a large percentage of the hauling capacity is foreign owned and would make it a lot easier for U.S. intermodal transit of diesel fuel by vessel, were the Jones Act reprieved for a while. But again, Unions all opposed to lifting that, so we've got no progress on that. We do have a strategic petroleum reserve of heating oil and diesel in the Northeast. Was put into place by Clinton back early in his administration, about 2 million barrels. Nothing has been done yet to release any of that. There's some talk that might be put on the table, which, you know, but in this case...
Would that be disastrous if we wind up having a hard winter in New England? Yes. And can't find other sources of heating fuel?
Yeah, we've got various analysts from Chevron to Gas Buddy, an analyst of oil and gas production in the U.S., talking about our ability to barely get past a cold winter, get past at these supply levels. And you, as a developed nation, you don't want to be barely getting past heating your citizens and keeping industry viable with diesel, right, such as it's used for intermodal transportation of everything.
But we may consider ourselves very lucky compared to our friends in Europe who may well not get past this hard winter if it plays out as we think it will.
Yeah.
But you mentioned when you last visited with us about this, Dave, that one other possibility would be restricting export of diesel. And you said you'd rather not be an unreliable supplier. But when push comes to shove, that may be another means of keeping some of this diesel that we would otherwise sell overseas here.
It would be. And, you know, before I do that, I would do SPR releases. At this point, the need is great enough to swap out light sweet crude for diesel.
Do that arbitrage.
Absolutely would do that. Mm-hmm. That would make a lot more sense. And I actually be less interventionistic in our trade relations with foreign trading partners who will value after this shortage, hopefully.
Yeah.
But no, we haven't done any of those creative things. Instead, we're auctioning the SPR off into global markets, including to China. While we're saying we're on a war footing, China is an ally of Russia. We're on a war footing, but we've sent them our SPR crude.
Yeah. I haven't heard them say we're on a war footing. I certainly believe we need to be, but we may be at war. That's for sure.
No,
but
he has used that phraseology in his letter writing to the oil majors to refine more and produce more.
Really?
Now, here's the issue with that. The chairman of Chevron spoke last week very effectively that, you know, we're not going to see another refinery in the U.S. We haven't seen one in 50 years. And he doesn't see this while the sector is entirely at odds with government policy on transitioning out of oil and gas as rapidly as possible. Mm-hmm. There is no investment climate in this country. Chairman Wirth of Chevron said no investment climate for adding capacity to refineries. Mm-hmm. Who would do that facing a government daily ranting on about ending reliance on oil and gas as soon as possible.
And the whole ESG mantra coming out of Wall Street as well, that's saying, you know, we're not going to finance these things either.
This is
lunatic.
Yeah, they're in the billions. They're in the billions, and it takes 7 to 8, 9 years to recover your bait, if you will, on those kinds of investments.
Right.
They're not short-term things. So facing that kind of a return horizon in this heavy CapEx industry, no one's induced to it, and particularly where one of your primary lenders has stood up and said, Moynihan, chairman of Bank of America, I'm going to ration lending. I'm not going to be lending as much to, or maybe none in some cases, to oil and gas producers.
Keep his ESG, credit score high. We could talk about this for a lot longer than we have. Let me just pivot very quickly to talk about something that we can only touch on, unfortunately. But Dave Walsh, there's been a confab going on in Sharm el-Sheikh, Egypt, about climate change. And the most important aspect of it, it seems, is how large will the reparations the developed nations, including ours, be paying to the undeveloped nations? What do you make of this, quickly?
It's lunacy. It's lunacy. It's absolute lunacy. I mean, for right now, the issue is China, if these fellows are worried about CO2. China emits more CO2 than all of the OECD nations combined. That's all of Western Europe and all of North America combined. So this reparations
and is ramping up their production of it.
And is ramping up. And Xi Jinping has said his coal-fired power generation is going to hang in there at 58 to 59% of his energy mix going forward. Hmm. It's not going to go up, but that implies an 8 to 9% per year growth in coal-fired generation along with his economy.
Yeah.
So he's not...
If this all makes a difference in the actual climate or the temperature of the planet, It's creating more of a problem, no question about it.
If it does, they're the guy.
We have to leave it at that. Dave Walsh, God bless you. Thank you for joining us. We'll talk next a bit more about China with Stephen Mosher right after this. Thanks for tuning in to Securing America with me, Frank Gaffney. If you find the content of this program to be informative and valuable, I'd like to ask you to consider playing a part in supporting the organization that makes Securing America possible, our Center for Security Policy. We call the center the home of the special forces in the war of ideas. We feature such warriors daily on Securing America as they diagnose the dangers facing our nation, develop strategies for thwarting them, and work with other veteran national security practitioners, legislators, and the American people to execute those strategies. Thanks to our friends at the American Family Network, we're able to expand greatly awareness of the Center for Security Policy's efforts and their impact. Like the real special forces, our effectiveness depends on having the ammunition, in our case money, to perform our mission. Please consider making a tax-deductible contribution at securefreedom.org. Thanks. We're going to talk now about China with a man who has studied it closely, lived in it, and probably understands especially the Chinese Communist Party and its workings better than anybody in the West. His name is Stephen Mosher. Proud to say he is a member of our Committee on the Present Danger China. He is the president as well as the founder of the Population Research Institute, very important organization, and the author of a number of books that are really valuable, notably Bully of Asia, which really talks about the character of this regime in China, as well as more recently, The Politically Incorrect Guide to the Pandemic. He is, I'm also very pleased to say, a pretty regular contributor to our programming here at Securing America. We're always delighted to have him with us. Welcome back, Stephen.
Good to be here with you, Frank.
Well, we were particularly anxious to catch up with you because earlier in the day, as we're speaking, the President of the United States had a face-to-face meeting in Bali with the, well, Emperor of China, the first communist one, that's for sure, arguably the most powerful of them. Tell us what you believe transpired in the course of that conversation.
Well, as always, Frank, there are two different accounts. There's the account that we get from Biden and the people representing him. And then there's the account we get from the Chinese Communist Party. And the two accounts often are quite different. In this case, the Chinese account I want to start with, because the Chinese account makes it clear to the 1.4 billion Chinese people that that the President of the United States came as a supplicant. He was the one, they said, who asked for the meeting, and he was the one who came to see Xi Jinping rather than Xi coming to see him. So you can see how they were setting the stage to show that Biden was, in a sense, subservient to the new dictator for life, the new Red Emperor, Xi Jinping.
China. So when you say he came to him, I mean, they both came to the G20.
Well, they came to Bali, of course,
on the margins
but it was Joe Biden and his delegation who came to the venue where Xi Jinping was staying. And normally, of course, in years past, it's almost always the case that countries that want to have their leader visit with the leader of the free world come to where he is. So the Chinese, I'm just mentioning this because the Chinese side is making a big deal out of it.
As more generally, they're
saying the balance,
rather contemptuous of the United States under Joe Biden, right?
The correlation of the overall general correlation of forces has now shifted in the direction of China. And what the Chinese side is saying is that that everything is America's fault, that it is America's unilateral, arrogant, and hostile strategy towards China that put Chinese and American ties in danger of spiraling out of control and towards open conflict. And in the future, the risk of confrontation between the two great powers will exist if the U.S. refuses to change its arrogant attitude and its hostile strategy. So you can see from the Chinese side that that they're expecting a lot from the President of the United States in terms of Taiwan, North Korea, climate, the tariffs, of course, and other issues pertaining to human rights. Now Joe Biden was able this time to express clearly what the U.S. one-child policy is, after having failed to do that four times.
One China policy, I think you
mean. I'm sorry, the one China policy is. Of course, he failed to express it on four previous occasions when he said, in response to a question, whether or not the United States would defend Taiwan, he said, "We will absolutely defend Taiwan." This time, he reverted to the general and, in my view, mistaken policy of obscurity, right? Of
not strategic ambiguity, as they famously call it.
Strategic ambiguity, not committing one way or the other to defend Taiwan, but simply saying that there was one China without specifying whether it was Taiwan or mainland China, and saying that the United States had an interest in maintaining peace and security across the Taiwan Strait. So he did this time get the policy correct.
Well, correct, according to the party line. But Steve, I think as you know so well, on those four previous occasions when he forthrightly said we would defend Taiwan, if it came to that, the White House or, you know, unnamed individuals in it would be trotted out to say, no, it's strategic ambiguity, no change in policy. So you're saying they just skipped that intermediate step this time around?
They did, and I certainly agree with the policy. I'm just saying that this was probably the high water mark of President Biden's participation, in that he was able to state clearly and succinctly what his administration's policy was. Now, I'm afraid that overall, we're going to be reverting, not surprisingly, to the Obama-Biden policy vis-a-vis China. That means, once again, we will be coming as a supplicant to China to say, please help us do something about North Korea. And North Korea will say, well, we don't really control Kim Jong-un. We don't control North Korea. When quite clearly they do, those missiles would not be taking off and hitting anywhere close to their targets without Chinese components. The North Korean economy would be even more of a disaster than it already is without Chinese food and other help. So on North Korea, we're going back to the old status quo, which is a danger for South Korea, a danger for Japan, and of course, a danger to the United States.
Plus, it feeds into this whole idea that the United States is a supplicant, and more to the point, what we have induced them to believe in all of the previous rounds, isn't it, Steve, is they'll get some concessions from us if they pretend to be helpful with, in this case, North Korea, or maybe it's climate change next time. Who knows, or both.
This is a game they've been playing successfully for the last 30 years, and of course they're loath to give it up because it puts them in the driver's seat and also gets all sorts of subsidies and concessions, not just to China, but to North Korea. Please don't launch another missile, we say, and then we give them a billion or two.
Energy or food or money. Yeah. Steve, we have to pause for just a second. We're going to come right back and we're going to talk a little bit more about what Xi's takeaway from all of this is and what it might portend for not just Taiwan, but for us and others, right after this. Welcome back. We're continuing a conversation about China in the aftermath of President Biden's meeting with what our guest has called the Red Emperor, Xi Jinping, the first Chinese communist emperor. And Steve Mosier is with us for this purpose. We're always pleased to have him, but especially to really take stock of the implications of what he has just shared with us, which is that unmistakably, the Chinese Communist Party, in the person of Xi Jinping, is feeling more emboldened, more assured of his supremacy over Joe Biden and the United States, and I would suggest even more contemptuous of us, none of which augurs well for peace and stability in the Far East. And Steve, to the extent that Xi is under some internal pressure in the banking sector, in the real estate sector, his zero COVID policies, his cumulative effects of the disastrous one child policy of which you spoke a moment ago, producing by some estimates 40 million military age young men for whom there are no women. All of this strikes me as the kind of thing that is likely to result in Xi taking advantage of what he sees as a window of opportunity. Yet there are those who are saying, wait a minute, Xi is now making some reforms. He's now talking about changing the zero COVID policy. He's now talking about making material steps to prop up the real estate sector and so on. Game this out for us. What's going on as you see it?
Well, let's talk about that in the context of Taiwan, because with the readout that we got from Joe Biden on Taiwan was that he said that that an attack on Taiwan is not imminent. Now, I do not find that expression very reassuring. Does he mean the attack on Taiwan is not going to occur next week or next month? We know that because the waters across the Taiwan Straits forbid that. It's too choppy and dangerous for an amphibious landing to be attempted. But
I thought
that was remarkably strange statement to make. On the economic front, Xi now is in absolute control of the Chinese Communist Party. And he has used the COVID zero policy as a kind of loyalty test of his subordinates. He locked down the entire city of Shanghai, of course, this last March, because that was the power base of Jiang Zemin and
his predecessor
forces from the previous president of China. It's not surprising to me that he would back off on the COVID zero policy now. He's toughened up the muscular rigor of the system. He knows that the security forces will absolutely obey him, even if he tells them to lock all of the Chinese people up in their apartments until they starve to death. So that's not surprising. In terms of the so-called economic reform, what that consists of is the Chinese Communist Party once again stealing the wealth of the Chinese people. And what I mean by that is this. It is the custom in China when you buy an apartment, and remember, half the economy is based on property development. It is a custom that you pay for the apartment before it is constructed. And so this money goes into the bank in an escrow account to be held by the bank and paid out only as the project, the apartment complex, say, that you're helping to build is constructed in a step-by-step level.
That's the way it's supposed to work.
That's the way it's supposed to work. What they have now said is that the property developers can now take that money out of escrow and use it for their own purposes. This will undermine the bank's balance sheets because there'll be less money on deposit, and that the banks don't care because they're guaranteed by the giant Ponzi scheme, which is the fiat economy run by the Chinese Communist Party. And who suffers from this when the apartment complex is not built? Who suffers when the property developer goes bankrupt? It's the ordinary Chinese person who was foolish enough to actually buy an apartment from a property developer, an apartment that doesn't yet exist, on the promise that it one day will. So again, this is theft from the Chinese people. This is the Chinese Communist Party looking somewhere, anywhere for money that it can take to prop up the economy. Again, over the long term, this policy, so-called reform policy, is going to weaken the Chinese economy by further terrorizing the ordinary Chinese consumer. It is not reform by any means.
This brings me back to the basic proposition, and Steve, you and I've talked about it before, and I think I know that you're generally in agreement. When you see totalitarians in trouble, they may have absolute political control, and yet there are problems threatening, at least over time, the regime. There is a tendency on their part, is there not, to engage in so-called social engineering, or, you know, finding some external threat on Absolutely. Which to focus their people's yeah. attention and justify the repression at home and get into, you know, perhaps a very costly conflict, yeah. including one that might take down substantially that large population of, cannon fodder at the moment. Those unaccompanied, unmarried and men without women.
Yeah, this doesn't mean these economic tweaks do not mean that the military policy, a strategic policy of gradual encroachment and possible attack is changing. It doesn't mean that the political policies are changing. The Communist Party will maintain absolute control. It simply means that they're tweaking the economy because in many respects it's near collapse. This is the new economic policy of Lenin in the early 1920s. It's Deng Xiaoping's four modernizations after the disastrous Cultural Revolution. It's just more of the same. And to see in this any sign of hope for major across-the-board transformational economic reform is once again going down the same primrose path that that analysts have followed for the last 40 years, to the peril of American investors. I think the other reason for this change in policy, of course, is once again, China is trying to attract foreign investors. They would be well-advised foreign investors to stay out of China.
Yeah, you will lose your shirt, especially if this balloon does indeed go up. And Steve, I so appreciate your insights into all of this, because it's a necessary corrective, I think, to some of the foolishness that passes for, you know, expert opinion on China, where it's headed, and what it means for all of us. And especially if the balloon could go up at any time, as Rick Fisher and others of our colleagues have said, whether we think the war is imminent or not, it may be upon us before we know it. Steve, thank you for your time. Thank you for all you do. Come back to us again with updates, of course, soon, if you would. I hope the rest of you will come back to us again next time here at Security.
Thank you, Brian.
Until then, go forth and multiply.